Special number 12879, Captain Eric Winkle Brown, Reel 4.
The analogy may not be quite correct, because in film terms, I suppose the actors move from the pilot to the designer. But no, that's true, and not everyone in the street knows the principle. I mean, 99 people out of 100 out there doesn't know who directed Star Wars, or Chosen Counties, or
yes.
The Godfather, or yes. Any of those pictures.
But then, this is it. You see, there are no stars like the old Clark Gables and Gene Harlow's.
I think the Navy has always had two basic crosses to bear.
Yeah.
One is that the senior officers in the Royal Navy have never fully accepted aviation as being an inherent necessity in any navy. They may regard it as a useful weapon to have around, but they are not prepared to say that anybody who becomes a professional in this specific area is good enough be a career officer in the Royal Navy. If you want to examine some basis for my saying this, if you look through the records of naval staff, I mean personalities in the naval staff for many years, from 1930s right through, you rarely find anybody with wings on their sleeve on the naval staff at all. When they did begin to get them in there recently, it was too late. The only first Sea Lord we ever had wearing wings was Caspar John, and he, great man as he was, arrived there because the Sea Lord immediately ahead of him died of a heart attack after being only months in the chair. So it was in some ways providence that guided Caspar into the chair. Thank God it did, because he looked like putting the naval air right back up into the top league again, and we were all set fair to get into the top league with this wonderful new carrier, the CVA-01, which would have come into service, and all the design work and planning was done under the aegis of Caspar John. Then, just as he retired from the Navy, we had a change of government and the whole thing collapsed. This is a way that politics plays such an important part in it. But getting back to why, as I say, that's the first big cross the Navy's had to bear, the non-acceptance of a professional body of men who have a full career to enjoy in the Navy if they're associated with aviation. The other thing is, there has always been, although it's often smoothed over, the fact is that there has always been a professional jealousy between the Fleet Air Arm and the Air Force. The Air Force took over the Fleet Air Arm at one stage. They ran the Navy's naval aviation in the 30s. They gave it up very reluctantly. They hankered after it ever since. They regard themselves with a certain amount of a positive argument that they should control everything that flies. This is rather the Goering attitude in the the situation was the same in Germany, in the Luftwaffe. And as a result, they have never been very helpful to helping the Navy to keep its aviation head above water. Recently, of course, you'll see we've gone the full turn of the wheel. We look like getting what might be called mini carriers back over the disguise of the name of through deck cruisers now. But many of the aircraft on them are going to be, the fixed wing aircraft are going to be flown by people in light blue.
Really?
Oh, yes. And indeed, the Buccaneers and the Phantoms had a number of crews recently, and as recently as the Ark Royal, which were light blue. So there's still this tendency to revert back. If you look at it, it's not, it goes across the board. It also permeates into the army. The RAF's relationship with the army up to a point is the same, because the army got into the light spotting aircraft. Nobody was too interested in that. They were rather regarded as a sort of small flying club in that sense. But then they became serious users of helicopters. And sure enough, the RAF managed to persuade powers that be that there should be a weight limit imposed on the kind of helicopter the army should operate. So anything above a given weight is in the RAF's field.
Like so the Pumas.
That's correct. So the army are restricted to the lightweight helicopters. Now, I can't believe that this is the best solution. I've heard the arguments pro and con, but possibly what worries the RAF is there was at one time a strong body that thought there should be no RAF at all. There should only be an army with its own air wing and a navy with its own naval wing. And this is, of course, reverting back to the situation that existed in the United States before the last war. I am not a supporter of that. I don't go as far as that by any matter of means. But I think there is room for a bit more give and take between the three services, and I would like to see more cooperation at high level. At working level, there is all the cooperation in the world. All the cooperation in the world. There is no problem at all when it gets down to squadron level. It's when you get up into the echelons of Whitehall that the problems start. And it was ever thus, I suppose it always will be. If you look throughout history, I mean, this isn't a new phenomenon at all. There's professional jealousy in every walk of life. In the services, it is possibly particularly strong because it's almost motivated by a fight for survival. When you have a budget, a defense budget, which has got to be sliced up, this really fosters professional jealousy when they're all fighting for a slice of the cake.
There's professional jealousy, though, vis-a-vis, you know, military aviation vis-a-vis civil aviation. I mean, Balfour's attitude towards service pilots coming in, for instance. And this rigid seniority system they've got.
That's, you're absolutely right. Yes.
Quite incredible that however good a pilot you are, your status is regarded with how many hours you've flown.
Yep.
In the right-hand seat or left-hand seat or wherever.
Yes. You're quite right. This is very, very, very sad in many ways. Because there's going to be a big change in civil aviation shortly. After all, when you realise that the majority of the senior captains now are all ex-wartime people, you've got a huge bulge in that area of these people, and very shortly they're all going to be coming up to retirement age, and they'll be replaced by people who've gained all their experience from graduating from a school like Hamble, through into the right-hand seat, then into the left-hand seat, and that is the total of their experience. Of course, excellent, but it's confined to a very narrow field. I suppose some airline captains go through life having flown not basically more than 10 to 15 types of aircraft. I wouldn't know, but I suppose it's quite possible.
I was hearing on the grapevine the other day that British Airways are experiencing a 60% failure rate on Commodore captain shortage.
Yes.
Of course,
that is probably true. It's certainly that is the type of rate that is certainly true in the services.
Yeah.
They're highly selective, I think, in both. And they can afford to be because the intake is so immense. We run, for example, here in this office, we run a government industry-sponsored scheme for helicopter pilots, a training scheme. We have an intake of 24 a year. And last year, for these 24 places, we had 3,500 applications. And in the course of the year between the last course running and the new advertisement, we've had 8,000 inquiries. So kids are, there's no shortage of youngsters that want to get into aviation. In fact, we're swamped with them. So under those circumstances, they can afford to be very, very choosy in their training, I think. This is what happens. And you've got to be choosy. After all, if you're sitting behind a piece of equipment that's costing X million pounds, you can't afford to be anything but choosy about the fellow who's flying it.
I do a lot of flying over the North Sea too. I can't afford to be choosy. Just there's one more thing I want to raise with you on naval aviation, and that is there a reason why all these new systems in carrier design seem to have come from the Royal Navy, you know, going back to the angled deck, the steam catapult, going right up now to the ski jump takeoff platform. I mean, is there a sort of the engineering branch of the Navy blessed with engineers that are then given their head, or what?
No, I think in a system like ours, the British system, there has always been more freedom of action allowed to the individual. If you look at the days in Farnborough, war years, it was always a matter of astonishment to me that you had a young boffin come in, pretty fresh from university, comes into Farnborough, he's given quite a large slice of money to get on with some project, and he's virtually given complete control. One I can recollect was a fairly young boffin, who is now a very distinguished boffin, who put a complete set of power controls on the Lancaster. Now, for all practical purposes, this was a redesign of the total control system. He had to go out step by step, ailerons, rudder, and elevator, and not just the whole thing on and, you know, one bang, each flight testing it. But he conducted that virtually undisturbed. Friendly eye kept on him, but there were so many other projects going on, the chap who was supervising it couldn't really delve too deep into it. And this is the way I believe that we've progressed. These people, when they have this freedom of action, the initiative is there, and they blossom under this. Up to a point, it's the same in the Navy. In carrier aviation and the submarine world is much the same, and there's the same flexibility of thought in them. Now, I've operated with the US Navy, very efficient Navy, but it's such an immense machine, that it has to be more carefully regimented. Somebody was just making a comparison the other day between the Civil Aviation Authority over here and the FAA in America. And you realize, here you have a small group of people. There they are, all in that building, for all practical purposes, they are worth in this division. You go to the FAA in America, There's a group at headquarters, and then there's a regional thing, a regional headquarters all over these, in each of these states. It's a huge machine. And the bigger you are, the more inflexible you become. And I think this is the real answer. That I'm sure the Americans, if they had the same freedom of action, would have the same, would be as prolific in ideas. At the level we are talking about, we're not talking at the top scientific level, we're talking about the working level.
And yet they're prolific in ideas in a different way. I mean, the Apollo operation.
Yes, we're talking, now you're on the top level, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Once you get up to the top level, they are...
On the ordinary administration. I mean, for instance, I don't know, is he still around, D.P. Davis? Or is he
yes, he's still
now?
Over there.
How he sorted out the 707's problems.
Right.
The Americans couldn't do it. I mean, I don't know if that's, that delightful story is true about ground stalling a 707, and they went galloping off down the sort of flat at Edwards and disappeared over the horizon and came back about 10 minutes later saying, you're right.
Yes, but you see, he's...
Lifting the nose too high.
Yes, yes.
Down,
yeah. Why is he? He's a chap who's been given a lot of freedom of action, really, over there.
Oh, he's a hero of mine. I mean, handling the big jets is my bedside reading.
Yes, it's a first-class book,
yeah,
isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's sold extremely well.
Mm.
And he's the sort of fellow that I think typifies... well, again, he's almost like Trump Show. He spans the two eras, really, doesn't he? And he's specialised in the big stuff, of course, to his every advantage.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things, you know, that we didn't talk about, I was just reading something I had written the other day for a magazine. I haven't sent it to them. They haven't published it yet because they're looking into it. It's the question of the Miles Supersonic Project. Remember the Miles M52?
I want to dig into that in the Public Records Office if they've got anything there, because that's public now, isn't it? 30 years. Just about.
I'll show you this thing. It was very, very interesting.